Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and thank you for joining us on another episode of Living History. We are in the middle of our, well, not in the middle, two episodes in to our absolutely fantastic, epic exploration of the entire Gallipoli campaign. We are breaking the Gallipoli campaign down into eight separate episodes. That's over 8 hours of content you will have all about Gallipoli. It just suddenly occurred to me that I hope the listeners are interested in Gallipoli, because if they're not, they're going to take a two-month pause from listening to the podcast, but that's okay. Hopefully most of the people are interested in Gallipoli. Joining me to carry on the story is the one and only Peter Hart.
Hi, Matt. I'm looking forward to it. We've got a big episode this week, haven't we?
Yeah, you're right, mate. This is probably the biggest. The landing in Anzac from an Australian perspective. And as we know, Gallipoli is a completely, totally, wholly Australian story.
There was no one else there.
No one else involved. So I'm looking forward to finally getting to the meat and potatoes of the whole story. Now, I'm being silly, of course. The one thing that we do, if you listened last week, is that we want to tell the entire story from every perspective. The French, the British, New Zealanders, Australians, and of course the Turks. We cannot forget the Turks. For far too long, Pete, you've made this excellent point so many times, and I've effectively stolen it, that for so long we've told the Gallipoli story just from one perspective. That's the perspective of the Allies, and as if we were just doing everything on our own. We cannot forget the bravery of the Turks, and indeed we're going to see a lot of evidence of that today. I do want to say, before we get started again, if you're enjoying this series and you don't want to wait, it's going to be stretched out over 2 months. If you don't want to wait, every episode is now available to listen to. You can binge if you want to, simply by subscribing for a small monthly fee. Click on the link in the show notes and you can subscribe and you can listen to every episode straight away and you won't have to wait. As we said last week, what will happen? What will the outcome be? No spoilers. It's going to be a good one, this one. The Anzac landing, Pete, the 25th of April, 1915. I mean, this is a funny one for me because I know it so well. I mean, I was almost reluctant to do this episode because what more could we possibly add to the story of the Anzac landing? But that, you and I were talking about this just before we started recording. We're going to add lots to the story of the Anzac landing because there's probably no chapter of the campaign that has more myths and misunderstandings swirling around it.
Yeah, it's more, and I don't think either of us should pretend to be particularly original in this. There's been a lot of good historians working on this recently, and this is sort of a little bit of a look at a summation of some of the new material that's been out there for the last 10 years, and an effort to understand why these myths have arisen, because they have. There's so much clouding what is quite a simple operation, really, and of course we don't like to hear it because of course we don't want it, but a tremendous failure. I'm afraid, and we need to look why. And one of the reasons why is because it's not Hamilton, Ian Hamilton. It's not Bridges. It's not our generals that really decide what's going on. In a sense, it's the Turks. They're already there. And it's their defensive plans that actually will set the parameters of what's going on. Because their plans are probably better than our plans, would you not say?
Well, they've had more time to put them together is the first thing. We cobbled this plan together in a matter of weeks, whereas the Turks have had, well, April, they've had 5 months of warning by this stage. 6 months warning, effectively, because the first operations took place in November, 1914. The Turks knew that the that the Allies were going to land at some stage, so they had plenty of time to put their plans in place. And I think that's one of the big reveals, especially since I've just finished working on my Krithia book about Gallipoli, and one of the big reveals to me was reading those sources. Harvey Broadbent has done wonderful work looking in the Turkish sources. Erickson, I'm sorry, I can't remember his first name, but an American historian, Erickson, and a couple of very good Turkish historians have been pulling records out and telling the story from the Turkish point of view. There's still a lot of work to be done. We've only scratched the surface, but my God, it's revealed some fascinating things about this first day. I mean, how many billions of words have been written about one 24-hour period in April 1915? It's really quite extraordinary.
It is. It is. It's absolutely amazing. Should we start with Turkish defensive? Yeah, let's get stuck in.
Yeah, so about
let's
the Turks.
Let's start with them. So who's in command of them? Well, it's General Liman von Saunders. He commanded the 5th Army, and they're in charge of that sector of basically the Gallipoli area, aren't they? And he identifies three main landing possibilities for where they could land a lot of people. And they are the Buller Isthmus, that's the neck of Gallipoli, he's got the 7th Division, he's got the 5th Division, he's got an independent cavalry brigade, that's throughout the campaign, that is a point of concern for him, as you know, Matt. He's, whenever we do anything, he looks to there to make sure that's all right.
It makes sense that that's where the Allies would land. It would be a good spot to land. If they were going to cut the peninsula off, land on the skinniest bit. That does make sense.
It does, except that they could still supply it by sea, and the objective is a long way away, because the objective, we've got to keep hammering this home, is the Kilid Bahia Plateau that overlooks the fort. So it's what they call the amateur strategist's landing place. There's actually a book called The Amateur Strategist which talks about it, you know.
Yes, but of course the Turks didn't know that, did they? If the Allies had landed and turned left for Constantinople, they'd be closer.
They would.
People should get a map out if they want to see what we're talking about.
Oh, there's plenty on the internet.
Let's not go too far down that rabbit hole. Suffice it to say that the Turkish commander, the German commander of the Turks on the peninsula, felt that the landing was going to be way in the north of the peninsula at the skinniest part.
Now, he didn't know that Kitchener, the Minister of War, had barred a landing in Asia. So he's also worried about that. So he has he worries about landing at Kumkali, worries about a landing at Bazika Bay, that's near opposite Tenedis, if you like. And he had a 3rd and 11th Division covering that. So he's got that. The Gallipoli Peninsula almost seems an afterthought. There's just one division, the 9th Division, covering that, but he also has the 19th Division acting as a reserve back at Bagali.
I think that the one point to say about all this, Pete, is in some ways British and French indecision and trying to do too much and trying to force the straits and trying to bombard the outer forts and moving supplies all over the place. In some ways, this has actually worked quite effectively, completely inadvertently, but in a weird, perverse way, it's actually been quite effective, because the Turks have absolutely no idea where the Allies are going to land. They know they're coming. They know what the loose targets are. But they have absolutely no idea where a landing could possibly take place. And therefore, they have to spread their resources out to cover every possibility. And what this means is that anywhere you look on the Gallipoli Peninsula on the 25th of April, the day of the landing, there are not enough Turks to cover that area that they're defending.
But in a sense, it's also quite clever, because they're operating what we would call a tripwire system. So their intention is not to stop you landing, but to hold you up, to embugger you, to use a highly technical military term, so that you're held up while the reserves march to you. And the reserves were the 19th Division under the command of someone you've heard of, Mustafa Kemal. They're the army reserve, and they're back at Bagali. Now, The 9th Division, there's 27th Regiment, they're guarding the Gaba Tepe sector, and the 26th Regiment would guard the all the way around the rest. But there aren't actually many troops there. They're sort of scattered out, as you say. Gaba Tepe is one of the main defensive points, the actual peninsula to the south of where we actually land.
So let's say, in terms of, we should establish something of terminology here. What we're going to use the terms for these places as they came to be known in the history from a British and an Australian perspective. So I think it's okay for us to say Anzac Cove, even though obviously weeks before the landing it wasn't known as Anzac Cove. We're going to do that too, and I think The other thing I think is interesting, Pete, is you talked about a tripwire system, and I know that Mustafa Kemal was actually not a big fan of this. He wanted to be there and, you know, having all these troops ready to go. But the key, if the Turks have established a tripwire system, as we always say in military, it's blow and counterblow, the key to overcoming that is, of course, to land a huge force just in one spot, which is, of course, exactly what the Allies did not do.
Well, he didn't. I mean, this is the problem with Hamilton for me. And throughout the Gallipoli, we've got to say Hamilton is, I think the Germans thought he was the most experienced general in the world. Not the best, the most experienced. He'd fantastic experience. He'd nearly got the VC as a junior, as a subaltern. He'd nearly got the VC as a brigadier in the Boer War. He was a fantastic chap in many ways. But when it comes to planning, he can't concentrate. And he uses excuses. He claims that they didn't have the right maps. He claims, well, that's not true. There's been books that have exposed this. He claims they couldn't have landed all in one place, but then he because they haven't got enough boats to land everybody, but then he spreads all the boats out all around. And he ends up trying to land almost everywhere. So he lands at five separate points on the Helles. He lands at Kumkali in Asia, to cover their backs. He has a diversionary operation at the Gulf of Saros, and he has a diversionary operation at Bazika Bay. And in the end, he plays into Lyman van Saunders' hands, because Lyman van Saunders has got a tripwire defence, and we sort of trip that wire in a lot of places, but nowhere in enough strength to actually do anything other than just fail.
We mentioned this last week. I used the analogy that it was like a gambler sitting down to the table without a big enough billfold and constantly trying to play catch up. The reality is, Pete, you've just described how few Turks were in each of the key landing places where a landing would take place. There actually weren't that many Turks there. The huge irony of all this is the Allies did have enough in the billfold on the first day, but they scattered it all over the casino. Had they just sat down at a table, okay, I'm torturing the analogy now, but you get the point. Had they just sat down, just focused on one place, either Helles or Anzac, doesn't matter. If they'd landed just at Helles, they could have then used the Anzac Corps to reinforce, and that would have made all the difference on the first day. Or had they landed at Anzac, they would have split the peninsula in two within the first hours, and away you would have gone.
I think most people now would say that they should have landed where the Kum Hotel is, just to the south of Gaba Tepe, all the way along Gaba Tepe, all the way along to Suva. They should have just landed everybody there, used the covering parties to seize the high ground and driven across to take Kilid Bahir in one, and not bothered with Helles at all.
But the whole point of Helles
is a rat trap.
There wasn't much of a garrison there. There was only about 1,000 troops guarding all of the, I think it's 7 kilometres of coastline or something. It's ludicrous. And had they landed all in one place, cut the peninsula in half, they would have been totally isolated, that garrison. So they probably would have either evacuated them in boats across to Asia and abandoned the peninsula, or the British and Australians would have swept down and overcome them in short order. Anyway, we're wandering well into what-if history here. No, but I think it's worth saying. I don't think it's the benefit of hindsight to say that this was not a good military plan. Not only were the Allies scattering their forces to hell and back across the peninsula, the landing points were way too far apart to be mutually supportive. It's not a bad idea in military terms to attack in multiple places, as long as those places can communicate with each other so they can support each other when required. And we've seen this, we saw this in battles on the Western Front, you know, exploiting success in one area, moving troops quickly to reinforce other areas where you're having success. So that was a huge issue with the landing plans, that not only were they scattering their troops, but they were not mutually supportive.
But I think we ought to turn to Anzac now. The task given to the Anzac Corps is... I mean, I know there's only a company facing the initial landings. It's only a company.
Let's put that in perspective. 160 men. That was how many Turks were in the immediate area of Anzac Cove to defend the landing. 160.
That's it. But the task they're given, the Anzac Corps, I think we shouldn't underestimate it, because they're making a night landing on a hostile shore, and they're not. They haven't. They've got to overcome the, I think, ill-defined would just about summing up. They've got to overcome the local opposition, whoever they are. They've got to take the high ground surrounding the landing beaches. And that, as you've been there, Matt, more times than you've had hot dinners. It's murder. And then they've got to get across to Maltepe, which we're obliged by law to say is the cone-shaped hill.
Cone-shaped hill.
Which I know you enjoyed that trip that me, with Belent Yorkmus and I went up there during our visit to the places that we never got to.
just to explain that in a little bit more detail, Pete and I, 5 or so years ago, did a fantastic trip of Gallipoli. We did the key sites, just the two of us, with Belent, our wonderful Turkish guide. We did the key sites that we wanted to go and explore and went bush bashing and saw some great things. But then we had pretty much an entire day where we did the what if campaign. So we went to all the places that the Allies were supposed to get to and never got anywhere near, just to gain a perspective on what it would have been like had they gotten there. So the Anzacs were supposed to capture the cone-shaped hill called Maltepe. And so we went there. We stood on the top of the hill and then we said, okay, what would this experience have been like for the Anzacs had they achieved that? We went to Kilit Bahir Plateau, again, as Pete said, the key objective in the southern half of the peninsula. And we stood there and it's a hell of an obstacle. We won't go down too far down that rabbit hole, but suffice it to say, it's extraordinary, and do it if you've got time. Go to Gallipoli and go to the what-if sites. What would the campaign have been like had the Allies actually captured their objectives?
That's absolutely true. And the thing is that, so on the first day, the Anzac Corps was to take the cone-shaped hill, which, sorry, but we have to say that, or we're struck down, Maltepe, and that was the first day, Matt, first day. Second day, they've cut the Turkish communication. They're to assist in the 29th Division capture of Kilit Bahir. We don't need mention this much more, do we?
None of it ever occurred. The thing that frustrates me about Hamilton and his planning, we've talked about he scattered his forces, he divided, they weren't supporting, but also chronically overambitious. It might not even have been too bad had he just said, okay, establish a beachhead on the first day, let's inch our way forward, let's do things methodically. But he compounded the issues of scattering his forces by also giving them plans everywhere that were ludicrously overambitious. Is that a fair assessment, Pete?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, throughout Antak, his plans are they're ludicrously optimistic is a friendly and reasonable assessment, not histrionic at all. Sometimes it borders on madness. I'm not saying he's mad. I'm just saying it's based
optimistic
on underestimating the Turks. That's what it's based on, and overestimating the skills of only partially trained troops, which is most of them.
And let's not forget that. We said it last week. We're going to say it every episode. A huge amount of this planning was based on the perception that Johnny Turk would not stick around and fight. And it is true that in previous encounters, they hadn't been the best soldiers in the world. But this is defending their homeland. They've had time to prepare. They're well dug in. They're defending their homeland. And we massively underestimated them throughout the campaign.
I better sketch in what exactly the Anzac Corps were going to do. We know William Birdwood is the overall commander of that. Let's look at 1st Division, because they're the ones who are first ashore. They're commanded by Major General Sir William Bridges, who barely features in the story, I'm afraid, because he is not an effective command controller. Operational controller. Then we've got the man who really matters is Colonel Ewan Sinclair McLagan, who commands the 3rd Brigade. Now, they are the covering party, and a lot of people misunderstand what they're meant to do. They are the risk body. They've got to get forward, and they are to seize not just the first ridge, which would be Pluggies Plateau to us now, not just the second ridge, which is where the actual line finishes up, but the third ridge, which we now call Scrubby Knoll or Gun Ridge. They've got to get right across to those three ridges and then hold the line, the outer line, behind which the other brigades and the New Zealand and Australian division can operate as formed bodies of men to seize the objectives finally. So they are a bit of a risk thing. That's what they're there. So they go ashore, the 3rd Brigade to do that. 2nd Brigade is under the command of Colonel James Mackay. They're to secure the whole of the Surrey Bear Ridge right up to Hill 971. That is just farcical. If they meet two Turks and a rough and a bad tempered Rottweiler, they're in a lot of trouble with those plans.
I say to people, look at a map as well. There's heaps of great maps that show where these things are. Hill 971 is way in the north. So it was their objective for the first day, and it's not a spoiler to say they never got anywhere near it, in spite of months of trying. Just check out a map and find there's great maps online which show what the objectives were for the first day and how far they actually reached. It'll make you weep when you see it, but. Ridiculous plans, impossible terrain, determined enemy.
Yeah. And the rest of the just finish off the 1st Brigade. That's Colonel Henry McLaurin. They're the divisional reserve, and it's only when they're ashore, and then the New Zealand and Australian division. That's godly, isn't it? Yes, it is. That only when they're ashore would they begin their advance on Maltape. You don't, as I say, you can forget Maltape now, cone shaped deal. We're never going to mention it again.
Let's just break this down a little bit, because it's a little bit confusing to understand. Even my editors of my Gallipoli book were struggling to get this. So during the course of the First World War, Australia would raise 5 divisions, New Zealand would raise 1 division. But at the time of Gallipoli, the earliest days of fighting, there were 2 divisions, the 1st and not really the 2nd. Basically, there was enough for 1 division, and a division is 3 brigades, so 1st, 2nd and 3rd Brigade. Then they had the New Zealand troops who there were not enough of them to make up a division, so they took the 4th Brigade, the 4th Australian Brigade, tacked it on to the New Zealanders and called that the New Zealand and Australian Brigade. So it's confusing. So we've got 1st Division, and then we've got the New Zealand and Australian Division, sometimes called the Australian and New Zealand Division, just to confuse things even further. But we've got 2 divisions made up of Australians and New Zealanders. And overall, the entire force is known as the ANZAC, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. So I hope that makes sense. 4 brigades, 4 Australian brigades, New Zealand brigades split into two separate divisions.
Now, I think for the rest of it, we've done a lot of talking now, but let's get on to the nitty-gritty. So we start now, as is our wont, Matt, to use the voices of the people who are there, channeled through us without amusing accents, although I am going to tempt you to just show this fine Australian hero. Let's start with Sinclair, Ewan Sinclair McLagan. Now, he's an interesting figure, and a lot of our thinking on this has changed over the years, thanks partly to a chap called Chris Roberts, who wrote a brilliant book on the landing at Gallipoli, which has really opened our eyes to a number of things. And one thing that's been absolutely clear is this man was not confident, and this is what he said. I'll read his quote, and he said this: "The commander of the destroyer." Oh, he's Scottish. Aye. "The commander of the destroyer Colne gave me his bunk, but I simply could not sleep. Although I knew that all the orders for the operations had been clear and most carefully thought out, had we, the brigade staff, provided for any and every eventuality? How was brigade headquarters to keep in touch with the units of the brigade scattered over 4,000 to 5,000 yards front on foot? If opposition was even only moderately serious, could units keep in touch with another? Was the reserve battalion placed in the right position? Were the poor maps issued to us accurate enough to be depended on, especially for the naval covering fire? If there was wire entanglement in the water on the north shore of Gaba Tepe, could the men get through it, or would they be drowned and so leave my right flank open? How could I replace them from the reserve? These and many other thoughts of a similar nature kept me wide awake until we got into the boats for the last few yards to shore." And that is not a confident man. And it's work. You have to remember that, because he, more than any other man, is responsible for the shape of the campaign. I'm not saying it wouldn't have been much different if he hadn't. But decisions he took in the first hour are crucial.
What I think's interesting about that quote, Pete, is he's providing hypothetical questions. If opposition was even only moderately serious, could units keep touch with one another? He's not actually asking that question. What he's saying is they're not going to be able to keep touch with each other. When he said, "Will we be able to, you know, communicate with the men?" What he is saying is we're not going to be able to communicate with the men. So he is doubting the plan that he has been presented with, but he's a team player. He's going to carry on. We should also mention he's talking about his brigade, about 5,000 men. In a brigade at this stage of the war. So That's how many people we're talking
about. That's a yes. He's just talking about the covering brigade, the men who are going ashore first.
Yeah, about 3,000 eventually that went ashore.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, it's
we'll
four battalions. There should be 4,000 in the brigade about, but, you know. Let's keep on. So the first wave, they're interesting. They're the ones that everyone fixates on. There's 1,500 of them. So they're two companies each from 9th, 10th, 11th battalions. And they go ashore from 12 tows. Each has got a steamboat tugging along three boats. You've got pictures of this happening. And this is one of the myths of Anzac. I remember Ashley Eakin, the very famous historian at the AWM, giving a lecture on the five myths of Anzac. And I only remember three of them because two dogs came along and started shagging just in front of him. And the British and the party were so laughing at this that we missed the last two myths.
You'll never know.
I'll never know what they were because Ashley wouldn't tell us in the pub, the bar afterwards. Good old Ashley. So they're to land between a... They didn't land in the wrong place, particularly per se, over the campaign. This is a point that has to be made. They were meant to land on a broad front from a point halfway along Brighton Bridge, that's just to the north of Gaba Tepe, to roughly speaking, the area of Fisherman's Hut, which is the next cove along from Anzac Cove. I've forgotten what it's called.
But we're going to do a little descriptive geography lesson here again, but please look at a map for this to make sense. But basically, here's what you've got. Here's the geography of the Anzac sector. There are two very long beaches to the north and to the south, and in the middle, a little tiny cove. The little tiny cove is, of course, Anzac Cove. The beach to the north of Anzac Cove is called North Beach, and the beach to the south came to be known as Brighton Beach. Now, the theories about landing on the wrong beach were that they were supposed to land on Brighton Beach. And it is true that that's the beach to the south of Anzac Cove. And it is true that the ground behind Brighton Beach is easier to cross. So they would have been able to cross it quicker than they could the very rough terrain behind Anzac Cove. They were supposed to land some troops at Anzac Cove. The northernmost troops were supposed to land at Anzac Cove, but the bulk was supposed to come ashore at Brighton Beach. So the idea that they landed in the wrong place, they didn't land in the wrong place, they just landed in too much of a bunch. They all landed at Anzac Cove rather big spread out.
I will talk about that because that's because of decisions taken by someone using their initiative. And one of the things about military plans is sometimes using your initiative is not a good thing. Who's there for the Turks? Well, there's elements of the Turkish 2nd 27th Regiment, I would call them. So the 2nd Battalion of the 27th Regiment. And they are in scattered outposts all along the 5.5 miles of the coastline from Agil Dare, which is north of Fisherman's Hut, right, which is on the beach to the North Beach. That's what it's called. That's right. I wondered why I couldn't remember.
So Fisherman's
it.
Hut is literally a little hut on North Beach. It's quite a landmark.
And that's all the way to, south of Gaba Tepe.
How far is this, Pete? This would be along the coast, 5 or 6 kilometres along the coast.
5 or 6. 6 kilometres, I would say.
Yeah.
Now, the ones who really involved in the landing are just this one company, 4th Company. And they've got 90 men of the 2nd Platoon on Ari Banu and Pluggy's Plateau. They've got 60 or 70 men, mainly 1st Platoon, in the hills around Fisherman's Hut. That's on North Beach. They've got a reserve 3rd Platoon back on 2nd Ridge. It's interesting that the Turks follow the German method because they're under German control to some extent of always having a reserve, and the regimental headquarters is on Gaba Tepe, and there they've got a couple of old the Nordenfelts. You see them, I think you saw one at the Tower of London.
Captured. It was captured at Cape Helles on the day of the landing.
The
thing that this strikes me, Pete, is that we're talking about a Turkish company. We're talking about the locations of platoons. A platoon's a tiny group of men. We're talking 20 or 30 men in a platoon if we're lucky. We're talking platoons spread out in defence, but from the Allied perspective, we're talking battalions. We're talking 1,000 men. So it demonstrates the imbalance of how overwhelming force the Anzacs were employing, that we would say, okay, the 9th Battalion landed against a half platoon of Turks. We're talking 1,000 men coming ashore against, 30 men that the Turks were using to defend. So we can't stress enough how outnumbered the Turks were at Anzac Cove.
At the start. By the end of the day, it's all evens, but at the start. And Set the scene. I mean, you're Australian. Can you? You've stood on and you've taken touring parties there for the 25th of April. What do you think? What must it have been like? What do you think?
Yeah, we mentioned it last week. The inexperienced Anzac troops, which is, you know, a polite way to put it, and, you know, enthusiastic amateurs, we called them, and coming ashore, and there's a lot of fantastic diary entries about how nervous they were to be coming ashore. It's a difficult operation. Amphibious operations are incredibly difficult. They usually don't go well. It's unusual for an amphibious operation to go well. We could find more disasters than we could find successes. But yeah, it must have been, they were very nervous. They were the first time in combat for all of them. And they didn't know what they were going to be facing on the shore. No intelligence at all about the Turks and what they'd be facing, and just these vague, well, these very ambitious orders to get inland.
Let's talk about what goes on. So the naval covering force, they're creeping in, and you see, this is one of the technicalities of it. They have to avoid the moon. Now that's going to set at nearly 3 o'clock in the morning, and they've got to be in there by dawn at 4 o'clock. Or they'll be sighted. In fact, they were sighted. We'll come to that later on. The battleships stop, and they put the men onto the tows. And the 12 tows got stopped. And you can imagine a little steamboat chugging forward. And then when they get very close, they'll cast off and row the last bit. Not the soldiers, sailors, because soldiers can't row. Now, this is one thing where a chap uses initiative. In the second but one on the right, He's in this boat going ashore. The midshipman, he's an old midshipman, which is a bad sign. I think he's about 28. He shouldn't be a midshipman at 28. Anyway, he seems a bright lad, but he sees looming on the right-hand side Gaba Tepe, because it's sort of, you know, just a dark shape. And you're going to read a quote from him in your best British upper-class accent.
I am indeed. Well, the thing I'll point out before I read this quote is just again with the geography, Gaba Tepe is a big promontory to the south of the southern beach, Brighton Beach. It is supposed to be their landmark on the right. They're supposed to see it because they're supposed to line up there so they can hit the beach because it's the most prominent landmark around. So this is what Midshipman John Metcalf of the HMS Triumph had to say. I realised that we were heading very close to the north side of Gaba Tepe, which, because of its height, is very conspicuous. Knowing that there were Turkish troops there and we would get an enfilading fire all along the starboard side, as well as from ahead, I was confident that we must be heading for a wrong place. There was no one to consult, and I felt the lives of the men I was towing were my responsibility. Without any delay, I altered course 2 points to port to get away from Gaba Tepe. That's a long way. 2 points. I'm not a sailor, but I know that's a good left turn. After a quarter of an hour, finding that the tows to the port of me had conformed, I again altered course a point and a half to port. Okay, that's a big swing left as he's coming ashore.
Well, I've forgotten. I did know, but you know, you write a book, you don't remember what's in it, and it is a substantial chunk. And the boats to the left of him, the port, as we Matelots say, they conform. So what happens is they're meant to be coming in 12 tows, and the tows on the right all start moving across the tows on the left, and they conform. And then there's someone on the left of the line, and he's a senior officer in charge of the flotilla, and he's not an idiot, as I'm sorry, Metcalf is. This is Commander Charles Dix. He's from HMS Majestic, and he says this. At first, all seemed to be going well, but when three-quarters of the way across, the right wing was seen to be steering across the bows of the centre, who were conforming to the movement, thus crowding the left wing away to port. By this time, some of us were awake to the fact that we were already some way to port of our objective, and so in order to save as much ground as possible, the left wing went on at full speed and held their course, only altering to starboard to avoid collision. It was instinctively felt that as soon as the first boat got ashore, every other boat would at once put her helm over and do the same, and that the quicker we got there, the less would be the error. The first approach of dawn was another reason for speed. Everything was absolutely quiet as we approached the shore, and there was nothing to lead one to suppose that the surprise had failed. But as the first boat touched the shore, a single shot broke the stillness, almost immediately followed by others, and the firing became general. So what's happened, Matt, is the ones on the right have turned across, The ones in the centre have turned across. They're all bunched together. Then Dix turns, accelerates, and then turns right to avoid the others. So they all end up. And where do they end up? You know, we've stood there together many a time. Where do they end up? Round?
They don't just end up at Anzac Cove. They end up all bunched about the northern headland of Anzac Cove, which is called Arabunu. And that's where they all came ashore, the entire covering force. And it's interesting when he says, we turned to port, and the middle ones did to conform as well. They bloody conformed, so they didn't get run into. You've got boats swinging across the front of them. Of course they're going to turn left. And so, yeah, everyone just, the ones on the right started turning left. Everyone just bunched up to the north of Anzac Cove. And the other thing is, the swapping, what does all of this swapping do? One boat coming in, another boat coming across it. You can't fit a battalion in a single boat. They're all going to land in a big mixed-up jumble, and that's exactly what happened.
It's completely jumbled up. And they had been spotted. They landed about 04:30. You're Australian, you don't know the exact time, but 04:30 will do for me. They have been spotted. And you're going to read a quote from Captain Fike of the 2nd 27th Regiment. What does he say?
He said, at about 2 a.m. that night, the moon was still shining. The patrols on duty from my reserve platoon reported having sighted many enemy ships in the open sea. I got up and looked through the binoculars. I saw straight in front of us, but rather a long way off, a large number of ships, the size of which could not be distinguished. It was not clear whether or not they were moving.
And this is the point. They do not know at this point that they're coming ashore. And why, Gary? You're not Gary. You're much better looking than Gary. Why? Why on earth would they come ashore at Anzac Cove from their perspective? It's not something they're expecting.
Absolutely.
They don't know where they're going. They
could be
going
in. No, go ahead. Go ahead, Pete. Finish that point.
Well, they could be going to Belair. They could swing left, or they could swing right to Helles. They could do anything.
Just a couple of points about that too. I mean, this is going to be the world's longest podcast, but I think these points are worth making. They didn't know where they were going. Allied ships had been chugging up and down the coast for weeks now. It was not unusual to see Allied ships. Also, the other thing that I thought was fascinating in the Turkish records when I saw, they were so determined, expecting that a landing would take place at Brighton Beach, which is where the Anzacs were supposed to come ashore. The Turks were so anticipating that landing that they had only a month previously done live fire exercises with artillery onto that beach from Garbatepe. So they had every square inch of the beach where the bulk of the Anzacs were supposed to come ashore, was accurately sighted under artillery. The only part of the coast that was poorly defended by the Turks, because the terrain is so terrible they knew no landing could occur there, was Anzac Cove. So forget all these ideas about had the Anzacs come ashore at Brighton Beach, further to the south they would have pushed inland and won the day. Forget it. If they'd come ashore at Brighton Beach, it would have been a scene out of Saving Private Ryan. It would have been absolutely horrendous. And as we shall see, as we delve in, it wasn't quite like that. Sorry, Pete, little aside there.
No, that's brilliant. And it does set the scene perfectly, because there's another Turk who I'm going to quote from, Private Adil Shahin. They're all 2nd 27, the Turks. And he's just an ordinary private. He has no clue what's happening. And he talks about his NCO. He says, he shook us and pointed down the slope to the water below. He said he thought he could see shapes out there in the water. We looked out and strained to see in the half-light. Then we heard noises and saw shapes of boats with soldiers coming ashore. We were ordered to start firing. Some fell on the beach, and I wasn't sure whether we'd hit them or they were taking shelter. They made for the base of the rise and began climbing. We were outnumbered, so we began to withdraw. It was very confusing. We didn't know anything about this invasion. We were very scared and retreated to the second ridge, firing as we went. I was very frightened. That whole quote has it just comes across as real to me. That's just about what you'd imagine, I think.
It's also fascinating that we may get to this later, but just that the idea was for the Turks to rush forward and to meet this landing head on. Unsurprisingly, they were not very keen to rush forward, and they took some shots, and then they safely scarpered. And interestingly, again, not forgetting the sacrifice of the Turks, the ones that did stay and follow their orders and hold out in the front line, just about all of them to a man was killed in the opening minutes of the campaign, as they were swamped by hundreds of men charging out of the Anzac boats.
Now, I want to make it clear, and this is that I don't want to upset Australian listeners, but so I'll do this if you see what I mean. Although I remember Chris Roberts I was telling one of your tour parties, and I was telling him a sort of slightly cautious and sensible version. And Chris stood at the top of behind us on the wall and shouted, "Nah, Pete, tell him what it was. There was no machine guns." And this has become an object of faith to some. In fact, one of your guides, it was an absolute point of religion to him. The other 40 of your guides were with Chris Roberts, I think is the we know where their machine guns were. There were no machine guns. There's a sound of machine guns. That's from our boats. There was a smattering of bullets. And there are pictures of the beach. It is essentially an unopposed landing with a smattering of bullets. That's the first wave. Second and third waves coming ashore get more fire from Gaba Tepe and from elsewhere. But the first wave get very little fire. And you've seen that famous picture of the beach. There's one corpse. And that corpse may not be a corpse. It could be equipment. And I just want to make that point. I'll save you making it because I don't want you to get Dear Matt letters.
I stand by greening. This point as well. It doesn't take anything away. A lot of men died on the 25th of April. The point to make clear is they died fighting in the hills later in the day, as we'll get to. They didn't die on the beach as they hit the shore, particularly that first wave. They came ashore virtually unopposed. It was pitch black, a few scattered shots, and then the Turks took off. The Turks on the northern end as well didn't rush forward, so the Anzacs were actually covered by the terrain. Do not think that the Anzac landing was like Saving Private Ryan. It wasn't like that at all. It was virtually unopposed. Yeah. It's even something that's been going on since the Gallipoli campaign, when George Lambert, when Charles Bean, the Australian who founded the Australian War Memorial, when he went back to Gallipoli in 1919 and took George Lambert with him, the artist, he could not convince George Lambert not to draw explosions and bullets pinging off the beach in broad daylight, in spite of the fact that he knew that was not the case.
It's
an important point. Plenty of people died. It does not reduce the level of their sacrifice. A huge number of men died this day. But let's understand why they died and what they were doing when they died. They died mostly fighting in the hills, not in the first wave of the landing.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I don't know why that should take anything away from the story.
I don't. I mean, they had a terrible day, and they terrible sacrifices, terrible fire, very heavy fire. The machine guns arrive on Gun Ridge. We know when they arrive, by 8 o'clock, with Sefik Akar, the Turkish regimental commander. We know when they did, but I don't want to upset people. So let's look at what happens. The people who land in those first boats rush forward. Most of them onto Ari Banu first. Bayonet everybody and go back up onto Pluggies, which is the hill. Which is first ridge to the now the next wave then begins to come ashore, and they're coming. They've been brought in by the destroyers, and they start to come ashore, and they land on the proper front. So they land halfway down Brighton Road, Brighton Beach, right across to North Beach and Fisherman's Hut, where, interestingly, they get shot to bits on the left and right. It is quite interesting. We have got a good quote with a lovely Australian accent. You're from Western Australia, probably. It's all one place, isn't it? Captain Dixon Herder of the 11th Western Australian Battalion. And he gives a good account, I think. And you've got a bit of acting to do halfway through on the next quote from him when you do.
Here's what he says. Here's what Captain Herder said. The pinnace went aground 36 yards from the shore. That's very specific. 36 yards from the shore, and the men in the boats were packed absolutely closely. We had to get out oars and row ashore under heavy fire. It took no end of a time to get the oars out, as they were 18-foot oars and the men were sitting on them. Five men were hit in the boat. At last our boat grounded, and I jumped out, as I thought, into 2 feet of water. It was up to my neck, and under I went.
Yeah, now, the point is, people say, but he's getting under fire. This is second wave. He's getting fire from Gabba Tepe, from the field guns. He is getting fire. That's what we're saying. Still not exceptional casualties. You compare this to the story of V Beach and W Beach, and you get a sense of perspective of what being under heavy fire is. Now, he gets up. He stumbles ashore, followed by his men. It's all very exciting. They're not long behind, the 10 minutes or so behind the first wave. And because of where they land, they often get, funnily enough, this wave gets inshore faster. Because the ones on the right, it's easier. They go up into the what becomes Shrapnel Valley and Monash. Anyway, what does Captain Herder say next?
This is after they got ashore. The action's thickening up now. We climbed up to the beach and lay doggo for a few seconds while everyone took off his pack and got a breather. Then round a winding, precipitous path, up, 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 we charged. Not a rifle had been loaded by strict order, and our boys did not waste their breath, cheering until we got to the top. Then a wild cooey and the bayonet. The Turk went for his natural. I think the uncanny silence and the fact that not a soul fired a shot got on his nerves in the dim light. Anyway, very few waited to give an exhibition of bayonet fighting, and in an hour the first ridge was won, save for some snipers concealed in bushes who lay doggo and got quite a few of the main body as they came on.
Now, Matt, this is the crucial point, because you read a lot of accounts. This is a bit of an idea that the Turks have run for it because they don't want to face the Australian manhood.
Cold steel.
That's not the case. It may be in some cases, I'm not saying. But what they're doing is, if you imagine, we can imagine it now. I can see it in my head. You've got up on top of Pluggies. In front of you, there's a valley, which becomes known as a rest gully. There's a jagged edge. There's another ridge in front of you. You don't know what that is. That's Russell's Top, but you don't know that. That's also part of First Ridge. On your right, there's Braun's Hill. What's that? Is that Second Ridge? Where's Second Ridge? What's that? You can imagine. So complex terrain, covered in scrub. What are the Turks doing? They're falling back and they're sniping. And it actually, Herder mentions it. And they don't seem to, in their heads, the British are the same at Helles. Oh, the Turks ran for it. Oh, cowardly chaps. And then they sniped us. That's what you do if there's, you know, 20 of you and a battalion comes sailing up at you. That you snipe. And who do they snipe?
It's not technically sniping, is it? It's sniping is a thought that we apply, on the Western Front with specially trained marksmen with telescopic sights. They're not sniping. What they're doing is being good infantry and being very well commanded. They are falling back whilst firing. So fall back, stop in a new position, fire some shots at the enemy as they come forward, move back again, stop in a new position, fire more shots. So they call it sniping, and simply that's a reflection of the fact that there weren't many men shooting at them. Had there been an entire battalion, it would have been a torrent of fire. But when it's 20 blokes trying to get back as best they can, it's scattered shots, so it feels like sniping.
But the reason it has an impact is because even Australians in those days, the officers had spaghetti junctions sort of stuff. They got very distinctive uniforms and markings. So what you're right. What these Turkish soldiers do is they shoot the obvious thing. So if you're standing there, Matt, commanding me as your corporal, and you're telling me what to do. Stood on top of, say, Pluggies, or say the next ridge, Russell's Top, the Turks will shoot you, and you'll be dead. And I, as your trusted, say, sergeant or corporal, will think, well, thank God for that. I'll get on with some real work now. But then they shoot you. And then Then other people come, the men of good character come forward. You know, we can all think, Bullent. Oh, Bullent's shooting us, I've just realised. But then the men of good character come, like Gary, for instance. No, let's save Gary for later. Then the men of good character come forward and they get shot. And then the men of bad character say, I'll just drag Matt's body back. Or I'll go for more ammunition, I'll go for orders. And there's a whole lot. It's a untold story because Bean had it censored in the British official history, and it's true. They become to be hundreds, nay, thousands of people falling back to the beaches. Are they all cowards? They are not. What are they doing? Well, they're troops who don't know what's happening.
They're leaderless. They're leaderless. And I think that's the point. Men don't fight wars standing up in general. Men fight wars lying down behind cover. And so what you have, inexperienced men, inexperienced leaders, as you say, the men are lying down. The officers say, okay, we've got to move forward. The officer is the first bloke to stand up. He attracts the fire. He gets shot. And so when we get to this situation where all the officers have been shot down, all the sergeants have been shot down, the men are leaderless. They don't know where they're supposed to be going. They've got no idea of the big plan. They say, well, let's wander back to the beach. I'll take Charlie back. He's got a bullet in the arm. I'll escort him back to the beach. And when they get there, they wait for orders and don't know what's going on. But the result is that hundreds, potentially thousands of men over the course of a day who should be in the front line fighting are hanging around at the beach. It's disorganisation. It's disorganisation of the highest order.
It's not cowardice, and I don't think it is. And are we simplifying what's going on? Yes, but we're simplifying it because the herder's position is wrong. You know, that he's got a worse perspective. What's going on is good fighting by the Turks, which are damaging the Australians as well. Now, they end up with elements of all three battalions, 9th, 10th, 11th, on pluggies, messing about. Now, one of the myths I do remember from that famous speech, it may be the last one that I remember before, is that the Australians dart too far inland. They rush too far inland, that they're so heroic and manly. That's not what happens. There are just very, very few parties. In fact, if you look at Bean's brilliant history of the first day, the official history, they're individually named. There's one's called Haig, always amuses me. But these people go forward to the Third Ridge.
Arthur Blackburn. So this is interesting. A small little aside, but it's worth so Lautet, the guy that came forward. So what we basically had, this is important to understand, is that we had scouts who were effectively rushing forward, dodging the Turks and trying to get to their objectives, because that was their job, to get forward, clear a path, and help bring other people up. So we had a number of scouts. Lautet was one of them. And these men went forward all the way to Third Ridge. But it was interesting, after the official history came out, Charles Bean received a letter from a man called Arthur Blackburn, who'd earned himself a Victoria Cross in Pozieres the following year. And he said, me and my mate Private Robin, we actually dashed forward, and they worked out they went as far forward as Scrubby Knoll on the Third Ridge. So Arthur Blackburn and his mate Philip Robin, are the men who advanced further inland than any Australians on the morning of the landing.
Yeah, because the whole of the 3rd Brigade is meant to get across there, Matt. Yep. They're all meant to get onto 3rd Ridge. That is their point, their stop point. That's where they'll stop the inevitable Turkish
counterattack. They're the covering force, and that's where they're going to cover. I think the thing is, Pete, and I might be jumping ahead slightly, but it's worth making the point, the fact that Lautet in one group of very small number of men, and a little bit to his north, Blackburn and Robin, sounds like Batman and Robin, no, Blackburn and Robin got to Third Ridge. When they got to Third Ridge, they were faced by waves of Turkish reinforcements, thousands of Turkish reinforcements, which we will get to later.
They start to arrive at 8 o'clock.
That makes the point that the whole plan was never going to work from the start. If a couple of blokes not fighting and just running as fast as they could only got to Third Ridge the same time as Turkish reinforcements arrived, it proves that the whole plan from the start was never going to work. It was too ambitious. The Turks could reinforce too quickly. And even had everything gone to plan, that proves that the Anzac plan was never going to work.
And what worse still is that Ewan, we talked about Sinclair McLagan. He's a good general, I think. I've got some time for him. But he right from the beginning, he decides that it's a ridge too far. Not a bridge, Matt, a ridge. And he just... And this is what I bow to Chris Roberts. He establishes that at 5:30, that's an hour after they landed, he orders them to stop on Second Ridge. And this is crucial. He doesn't. He's worried about being counterattacked. He loses hours, which they could have got to Third Ridge. Perhaps they'd have met the Turks earlier. I don't know what would have happened. I'm not optimistic about that. I'm with you on that. But it could have done. But even worse, he then tells Colonel James Mackay, 2nd Brigade, he tells him to go to Second Ridge as well. He's meant to be going to Chinook Bay and up to Hill 971, but he ends up with his men there. And this is how Anzac ends up being the shape that you and I know and love to visit, because Second Ridge is as far as they ever get, essentially, through the bulk of the campaign. And when the 2nd Brigade come ashore, they end up a few end up on the left and get shot up from Fisherman's Hut. I think we ought to have a look at that, because there's a nice little quote, isn't there, from one of the Turkish defenders at Fisherman's Hut. And that's 2nd Lieutenant Ibrahim Hayrettin, 27th. He says this: "We faced..." And this is a real, you know, tough Turkish type of thing. "We faced them with our few weapons and our faith, and thanks to the devastating fire we rained down upon them, within an hour's time we had felled and destroyed so many invading soldiers that the shores were covered with their bodies. Following this, and respecting the dictates of war, whereby one must strive to hold the high ground, we went up to the hill of Chinook Bayir, which dominated the positions held by the enemy. And then, after having left some of our men there, we pretended that reinforcements had come from the rear and surged forward towards the enemy, getting close enough so that our weapons would be effective, and stopping them by engaging them with our intensive fire. In this way, we managed to gain time in favour of the main forces which were following behind us." And that is the point. I mean, you can perhaps make the point that of what Liman's defensive plan was, because this is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, just for clarity there, this area they're fighting is north of Anzac Cove, which was always, again, supposed to be part of the landing. But by this stage, the Turks are fully aware that everything's going on. These blokes that we've just mentioned had not been involved in the fighting up until this point, because all they'd seen was thousands of Anzacs landing further south and hadn't been able to do anything about it. And now, all of a sudden, part of the second wave comes in right underneath 7th them
Battalion,
at Fisherman's
Hut.
And they absolutely cut them to pieces. This was the only place on the Anzac landing beaches that where they came under heavy, sustained fire. It was really quite horrific. So the Turkish plan was basically as you described, is that forward outposts, multi-stage plan, really forward outposts, who were simply just supposed to act as lookouts and not stay and fight, they would then fall back to prearranged trenches where other men in their platoon would be. They would hold out as long as they can. Then they would launch this fighting retreat. But the key, of course, Pete, reinforcements. We had an entire division. You know, we had 10 or 15,000 Turkish troops not far behind the Anzac sector, ready to pounce. You know, they're like a cat waiting to see which hole the mouse comes out of. And as soon as they do, they're going to throw their weight on that spot, and that's exactly what happened.
And there's another stage that we mustn't forget, and that's Lieutenant Colonel Mehmet Sefi, Sefi Gakar, I always call him. He's commanding the rest of 1st 27th, 2nd, 3rd 27th, and they're back at our old holiday destination, Maidos or Eşyabat, and they are also waiting. Those two battalions, they get their orders and they start to march forward at 5:45. And well,
let's mention Sefik. He's a complete hero of this story. He's the one that's overlooked. Mustafa Kemal, you know, not undeservedly, gets
also
a lot of attention.
Hero.
But Sefik is absolutely a hero of this story. It's really quite extraordinary. So that we're mentioning him, because people should know
He reacts, as you know, Matt, he reacts before Kemal Atatürk. Oh, well, that's not Atatürk then, Mustafa Kemal. He reacts first, and he asks for orders, he gets orders, and he starts to march. And they march through the valley, hiding under the lee of the hills as best they can. And they're the ones.
Sefik and his men had already been doing exercises in this area, because Sefik was very focused on this terrain. He knew it very, very well. He knew the Anzac area very well. They'd been doing night manoeuvres. He expected that this would be where there was a landing, so as soon as he heard there was one, he got his orders. And he took off. It was, you know, a brilliant move, a fantastic defensive move.
And he gets up on Third Ridge around about 8 o'clock. He's the one that this is that there's two battalions. There's 2,000 troops arriving. Blackburn and other people, they've got no bloody chance. This is the hordes that they see. And yeah, I could see from their perspective, if there's three of you or two of you, then 2,000 people arriving. Anyway, what does Sefik Akar say, Matt?
He has to say, We guessed that the enemy was advancing slowly and cautiously in order to capture the ridge where we were, which dominated all sides, namely Churuk Bayer to Garba Tepe. That's the entire Anzac
third
sector,
ridge.
Effectively. We set about the task of throwing the enemy, and we felt a moral force in ourselves for performing this task. All the signs indicated that opposing our 2,000 armed men was a force of at least four or five times that size, or even bigger. We had to prevent the enemy from reaching and occupying the dominating line of Churuk Bayer, Garba Tepe, and had to gain time until the 19th Division arrived.
And that's it. It's brilliant. What he's doing, he's recognised his role. It's brilliant command leadership. It's brilliant leadership. I must hold this line. I must engage them until the main reserves, the Kemal forces arrive, the 19th Div. And the 1st 27th and 3rd 27th, they develop an attack from 3rd Ridge across Leg Valley onto 2nd Ridge. 2nd Ridge is the what becomes the Anzac front line. And he also has his four machine guns. Because we know exactly where they were, and they don't lie about it, that's where they are.
The interesting thing, Pete, is that the one thing that that he doesn't have, and that most of the Turks don't have in these opening stages, is artillery. The key to the First World War battlefields is Sefik rushed forward so quickly he couldn't bring his slow-moving artillery with him. So the one disadvantage the Turks did have, well, obviously the Anzacs weren't landing artillery either, but a huge impediment the Turks had to stopping the Anzacs was a lack of artillery guns. And so Sefik was employing literally individual guns to fire in support of counterattacks. So again, masterful leadership.
He eventually gets a battery of guns, but it's eventually. You're entirely right. Now, I've got a quote.
It's men and rifles. It's men and rifles, initially. He's got some machine guns with him, but mostly in the opening hours, it's men and rifles doing brilliant work.
And there's a quote that gives an idea that the Australians are pouring more and more men up onto 2nd Ridge and 400 Plateau, which is at the end of it. It's where Lone Pine is now, I think would sum it up. And this is Private Herbert Fildes of the 12th. That's South and Western Australian and Tasmanian. Don't forget the Tasmanians. They're devils when they're roused. Battalion. And he says this. Four of us lay under shrapnel, machine gun and rifle fire, not daring to lift our heads to the whole while. This is over the whole day. I want to make that clear. If we had budged, we would have been killed dozens of times over. The bullets were streaming so thick over our heads. My rifle, which I placed just a bit ahead of me to protect my head, was chipped two or three times, and the dirt was plugged on either side of me. Our officer said he'd never seen anything like it, and he's an old soldier. I was jolly tired, too. And as a matter of fact, I went to sleep twice. It made no difference whether I got hit sleeping or waking, as I couldn't shoot from the position I was in. The only thing to do was to lie low until the fire slackened. It was about 3:30 p.m. when I got hit. So this covers the whole time. I want to make... He's not contradicting what you've said. He's just, you know, adding to it. So what happens next?
Well, next, the cavalry arrives, pretty much. The reinforcements streaming, not the literal cavalry, but the Hollywood cavalry. Mustafa Kemal, the hero of not just the Gallipoli campaign, but all of modern Turkey. 19th Division, he's on his way. Sefik knows he's on his way. They've been communicating. And it's one of those incredible coincidences, Pete, is that Sefik, through coincidence, was coming effectively from the south. And Kemal, with his entire division, was coming from the north. And really quite extraordinary. And Kemal, completely without orders, decides instead of just sending a battalion or two, as Sefik had asked for, he's going to bring a whole regiment. And this, I think, Pete, this is just my opinion, but I think this is what made the difference. Kemal deciding to bring his entire regiment instead of just a battalion swung the balance in the favour of the Turks on the opening day. So... shall I read his famous quote when he got to the high ground? So, see, he arrives in Churuk Bayer, which is the high ground famous for New Zealand fighting later on. He got there ahead of his men. He's got his whole regiment coming up behind him, but he arrived there ahead of his men, and he saw a group of Turks retreating and firing and rushing backwards. And this is his famous quote that Ataturk said. This is what he had to say. To my mind, there was a more important factor than this tactical situation. That was everybody hurled himself on the enemy to kill and to die. This was no ordinary attack. Everybody was eager to succeed or go forward with the determination to die. Here is the order which I gave verbally to the commanders. I don't order you to attack, I order you to die. In the time which passes until we die, other troops and commanders can take our places.
What a great appreciation of the tactical situation that man had. Whether Sefik Aker's your hero or he is, it doesn't matter. They're both brilliant commanders. And this, and actually, the core commander's got a good appreciation, whose name I've forgotten. I'm not going to remember just now. But the Turkish core commander's got a great appreciation of what's going on. Better than the man Von Sanders, who's still watching Belair for most of the day. You know,
he disappeared. Von Sanders took off early in the morning to go and see the landing, in quote marks, at Belair, which never eventuated for the whole day. It was a complete crisis in the Turkish high command, and luckily he had good people below him, like the corps commanders and like Kamel and Sefik, because they took matters into their own hands and really saved the day.
Now, we're going to have to accelerate the story now, because people have only got so much time to devote to listening to us two.
This is going to go on longer than the actual day of the landing.
That's what I'm thinking. The Australians, there's a very few have got up onto Battleship Hill, and they're totally just booted off. They are smashed by Kemal's counterattack. Battleship Hill falls to the Turks, and then they surge onwards. And there's loads of accounts, fantastic stories that we can't have. Just read the books about it. Read my book, read other people's books. There's a lot, most of all, read Bean. There's just so much. But the essence is that they sweep forward and they're only stopped as they get towards the neck and actually Russell's top behind the neck. If they'd got on there, it really would have been bad. It couldn't have been better from the Turkish point of view, the way that you mention it. It's just perfect. It's just perfect, the way that it works for it. And it's very hard luck for the Anzacs. The Anzac commanders are not showing anything like this level of leadership. The only one who's showing his head, really, is Sinclair McLagan, and he's the opposite of dynamic in this particular case. He's not a bad general per se.
Just what Pete's talking about there, again, for absolute clarity, is Sefik was in the south, loosely. He arrived just before Mustafa Kemal with his reinforcements. Because Sefik arrived in the south, the area, loosely the area around Lone Pine, as more and more Anzac reinforcements came ashore, they moved to the sound of the guns. That's where the fighting was happening. That's where people were dying. And so they kept landing and then turning right and heading for Lone Pine. Their orders said that they should be going left and heading for the high ground of Chunuk Bear and Hill 971. But they didn't do that. They kept turning right. They kept turning right. They kept heading for Lone Pine and 400 Plateau. And then, just at the moment where they were stretched the thinnest in that right sector, Mustafa Kemal arrived on the left, where they should have been heading, and launched a counterattack, which destroyed any plans. I mean, they were lucky they weren't completely overrun, but it destroyed any plans the Anzacs had for securing that high ground, and they never got there for the rest of the campaign.
Now, I've got a quote from... it gives an illustration of the confusion, because it's not just the news of the Australian division, the first division. It's also the New Zealand and Australian division. They also get sucked into this. And this is a quote from Sergeant R.H. Harris, Auckland Battalion, fine body of men, New Zealand Brigade. And he says, "There seemed to be no organisation. The officers were all away on a reconnaissance, so we found that it ended up with a whole stream of men going up the gully, and the only thing to do was carry on." I presume that's Shrapnel Valley. We carried on up the gully, being pushed from behind. We found it rather tough going. We soon got warm. There was a little water in the bottom of the gully, but there was very sticky mud, and this dragged on our feet, so that a number didn't seem to be able to keep up the pace that I was setting, and I was forever urging them to hurry along. We passed streams of Australian wounded going down the gully, and they were all urging us to go to this place or that, as reinforcements were wanting. I think what really happened to the Auckland Battalion was that they went to a number of different places, just as their inclination took them. But as far as I was concerned, I ended up far up on the left on Walker's Ridge. So he may have been in the valley between what we call Mule Valley later on. I mean, I'm not certain where he was, and I'm bloody certain he wasn't.
That's a good point. It sums up the confusion. I think that's the thing. It's confusion. The idea is that the reinforcements are arriving, and as they're going forward, men are coming the opposite way, wounded men or leaderless men, and saying, go right, we need you on the right, or go up to the left and see Lieutenant Harris is waiting for you up there. It's just confusion. And so small parties of men, rather than pushing forward in organised form, ducking all over the place and just make compounding the chaos of the landing by the chaos of the front line. And it took a week to get them all sorted back into their correct battalions.
And in that terrain, no one is casting any blame for this, or certainly not any historian of any repute. The other thing is, it's an invisible enemy. That if you read the accounts, nobody sees any Turks hardly at all. They're just bullets. And this is a quote that you're going to read from Lance Corporal Eric Moorhead, 5th Victoria Battalion. What's he say?
Well, just before I read it, Pete, the thing that this quote sums up to me is that what you have on the day of the landing is not a huge battle with two sides. You have 1,000 tiny battles going on. Every officer is leading his own little group of men in a tiny little battle on both sides. Every Turkish officer is fighting his own little war right in front of him. And they're all connected, but as far as those men are concerned, they're interested in the 10 feet in front of them. And this quote certainly sums that up. So Lance Corporal Eric Moorhead of the 5th Battalion. The officer ordered a bayonet charge. We lined the ridge and with a shout, doubled over it in a long line, expecting to find the enemy at close quarters. We were now in a scrub-covered plain, fairly in the open. No Turks were to be seen, but the air was literally full of bullets and the sound was deafening. The point-blank explosion of rifles and the concealed snipers firing on us at close quarters. The bayonet charge had failed and the men became disorganized. Some ran about distractedly, poking in the bushes for Turks. Others fell on their faces, rendered nerve-racked by the terrible fire. I ran forward into a slight depression in the ground where several men were lying and found myself beside one of my meaner tent mates. Some of the men were wounded, others dead. Still no Turks were to be seen, and there was no target for our rifles. Some fired a few shots aimlessly into space, but were warned that they might easily be firing on their own men. Others were hit in attempting to assume the firing position. I mean, it's chaos, isn't it, Pete? Just chaos.
Yeah, the capture of Baby 700, the rest of it. As we mentioned before, the neck is under threat. Russell's top's under threat. It's a disastrous situation. Mustafa Kemal's arrive in 57th Regiment causing chaos on the left.
And let's point out, this is only 2 kilometres, 1 kilometre inland from the beach where they'd come ashore. They're still only fighting for a beachhead. They're not fighting for ridges and objectives that are going to help them win the war. They're fighting just to secure a beachhead. They're fighting for their lives. It's a kilometre inland, and eventually the Anzac line would stretch for 2 kilometres. It's a tiny area.
And I think, just to respond, the Turks are having trouble getting their artillery forward. They are, absolutely. But we're having trouble getting our artillery. We try and get some of the Indian Mountain. They come ashore. They have to be... where are we going to put the guns? The flat trajectory. I mean, if they're not howitzers, they can't fire hardly at all. Naval guns? How can they fire? They can't, because they've got flat trajectory fire. They can't hit things because the Turks are out of sight.
And you make a great point, Pete. We've got to remember what's behind these armies as well, because that's crucial. The Turks, what they have behind them is kilometres and kilometres of flat plains and, you know, effectively the rest of Turkey behind them to bring up reinforcements, roads to bring up artillery. The Anzacs have behind them nothing but the deep blue sea. So it's an impossible position. They can't reinforce. They can't bring up supplies. They can't bring up guns.
Now, the chaos just gets worse and worse. And I always like one of my favourite people, one of my favourite New Zealanders, mainly because... he's got so many quotes. It's a brilliant book that has been written about him, which has many quotes about how much he loves Australians.
you might have gotten that wrong there, Pete. I think he doesn't love Australians.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great book.
Colonel William Malone, one of the true heroes of the campaign, but a miserable and bad-tempered bugger as well, which is probably why I like him even more. He says this, and you get the personality of the man in just this short quote. There doesn't seem to be much organisation on the shore. In fact, it was disorganisation. We evidently haven't got a Kitchener about. On paper, it was all right, but in practice, no good. Still, Britishers always muddle through somehow or another. The heads, like General Birdwood and Godley, plan all right, but the executive officers in the main are no good, have no idea of order, method, etc. They, as I put it, hang up everything on the ground. And he's just, I mean, it's just a disaster. Who's got the key ground, would you say? Who's got the most important ground at the end of the day?
Well, the most important ground is the high ground, and the Turks are there. So, again, we think about what's behind these armies. The Turks could arrive on the high ground without fighting. The Anzacs weren't there yet. So they approached the high ground. They seized the high ground without a fight. And then from there, they could defend.
We need to say, it's not that the Australians and New Zealanders have performed badly. It's that the military situation is almost impossible for them. Yes, they have one thing in their favour, numbers. But numbers aren't everything in a great war battle, because you get slaughtered. And given the terrain as well, the terrain is impossible. And in the end of the day, I think the Anzac Corps senior commanders, the divisional commanders, we notice how we haven't mentioned them, unlike the Turkish commanders. That's because they're not doing anything. Let's have a, you give us a quote. Give us a quote to sum it up from an Australian hero. He's not Australian, but he's well regarded in Australia. Birdwood.
This is Lieutenant General Sir William Birdwood, who was the commander of the Anzac Corps. Both my divisional generals and brigadiers have represented to me that they fear their men are thoroughly demoralised by shrapnel fire to which they have been subjected all day after exhaustion and gallant work in the morning. Numbers have dribbled back from the firing line and cannot be collected in this difficult country. Even the New Zealand Brigade, which has been only recently engaged, lost heavily and is to some extent demoralised. If troops are subjected to shell fire again tomorrow morning, there is likely to be a fiasco, as I have no fresh troops with which to replace those in the firing line. I know my representation is most serious, but if we are to re-embark, it must be at once. And he sent that message to Hamilton, his commanding officer. I mean, you know it's a shit show when that's the message you send to your boss.
Well, it's amazing.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
He's talking about shrapnel fire. I want to make it clear, because I want to make that sometimes it wasn't a lot of shrapnel fire, firstly. And secondly, most of it was coming from Gaba Tepe. You've got to remember how small it is. They're firing in from the right flank, from the southern flank. And by this time, by the evening, they have got a battery of guns up on Gun Ridge, as they call it, because that's where they end up. Now, how does Hamilton react? Hamilton reacts in a Hamilton-like fashion. He decides to stick it out. It's always said that the news of that... is it AE2? Yeah, I don't think that had any real impact on his decision. He uses it as something. But what he says is this, and it's, "Your news is indeed..." I'm tempted to do a stupid voice, but I won't. "Your news is indeed serious. There is nothing for it but to dig yourselves right in and stick it out. It would take at least 2 days to re-embark you, as Admiral Thursby will explain to you..." With a Venn diagram, I expect. He didn't say that. "Meanwhile, the Australian submarine has got up through the Narrows and has torpedoed a gunboat at Chinook." That is just... That's a non sequitur. I'm sorry. "Hunter Weston, despite his heavy losses, will be advancing tomorrow." Oh, yeah. "Which should divert pressure from you. Make a personal appeal to your men and godlies to make a supreme effort to hold their ground. P.S. You've got through the difficult business. Now you only have to dig, dig, dig until you are safe." What do you think of that, Matt?
Well, my first question is, how is digging going to help you reach Constantinople? But anyway, do you know what I think about this? I actually, in spite of it's a bit fluffy, the writing, Hamilton made the right call. A couple of things to say about this. There's two things I want to say. Firstly, Birdwood's message reeks a little bit of panic to me. It's a pretty, "Oh my God, it's an impending disaster." Hamilton is the man that calms the nerves and says, "Let's just get on with it." I think the important thing is to say, though, that often what gets misconstrued here is that Birdwood was panicking and saying, "It's all a disaster, let's just pack up and go home."
He was.
He wasn't suggesting, though, that they pack up and go back to Egypt. I think the military thinking behind this has to be comprehended as well. Birdwood, had they evacuated, Birdwood's plan would have been to re-land at another spot. You know, this isn't working. This was supposed to be a bit of a left hook, which hasn't quite worked. You know, my assumption from this is that Birdwood suggests, let's re-embark the men and then put them ashore where they're more useful, at Cape Helles or somewhere else where they'll be more useful. So I think it's an interesting exchange. I think, in spite of the fluffy language, Hamilton made the right call. There was no way they could evacuate.
I agree.
From this point onwards, It did sort of bind the nerves a bit more of the Anzac commanders and encourage them to stick it out, which they did. And a very interesting exchange. What have you thought about this exchange, Pete?
Well, I think I agree. Fluffy language is the very least of it. I mean, it's full of just strange things. But I think he's right, because if they tried to evacuate, they'd have lost most of their men, I think. because the Turks, once they got through onto the neck, onto Russell's Top, which they would if they started to evacuate, then there would have been a massacre.
The only thing that stopped the Turks pushing the Anzacs into the sea was dogged resistance on Second Ridge. The Turks couldn't get forward. The Anzacs couldn't get forward. It was a stalemate. Had the Anzacs broken away from that, started to pull back, the Turks would have rushed all over them.
Again, we want to make the point that we said they didn't suffer that many casualties on the beach. It was the second and third waves, and even the New Zealanders coming ashore came under shellfire on the beach. But they did suffer a lot of casualties during some very intensive fighting in terrible situations, in difficult ground, against very experienced and well-led Turkish opposition. Who won the day? There's no question about that. And you're Australian. Who won the day?
Oh, the Turks absolutely won the day. It was a huge disaster, the Anzac landing. And it's not to take anything away from the men. The men did... No. I think the amazing thing about the day of the landing is the men did so well, considering the circumstances. The confusion, the landing, the determined resistance from the Turks, the quick and smart application of reinforcements. I think the Anzacs did absolutely brilliant in those conditions. But from a military standpoint, they had objectives that were, I think, 6 kilometres away from where they dug in. They dug in on a front line that would not move for the next 8 months. And
yeah,
it's just quite extraordinary. It's really quite extraordinary.
And we've got to remember that the Turks, you made the point, the Turks just move up another couple of regiments. That's a regiment, remember, is equivalent of our brigades almost. And they move the artillery up. And the front is frozen. And it's frozen from then right to the end of the campaign. That's it. It's always sad to have to admit that a British, an Australian, a New Zealand thing is a failure, but there's no real understanding of what happens at Gallipoli without grasping the nettle. You've made the point. We're not criticising individuals as soldiers. We're criticising the command decisions and the way it was carried out. That's what we're criticising.
Yeah, about 3,000 casualties on the first day between the Australians and the New Zealanders. About a third of them killed. In fact, I think it was about 50% killed, which is an extraordinarily high proportion of those casualties. And I think it's no exaggeration to say the Gallipoli campaign was over on the first day at Anzac. When they dug in on Second Ridge, 6 kilometres short of their objectives, having lost so many men, so much confusion. As we said, it took them a week to get battalions organised again. And every hour that ticks by, the Turks are streaming more men in to higher ground to pen in the Anzacs in that sector. So it was an extraordinary achievement to hang on as long as they did. But from my point of view, as far as the Anzac sector is concerned, the Gallipoli campaign was over on the first night.
Yep. Cheers.
Not more to say after that, Pete.
No, I can't think of anything else. It's a bit depressing, really. But let's hope there's some good news in the next podcast about the landing at Helles. I'm sure that goes well, eh?
Can't wait. Thanks, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.